Welcome to another episode of the Untangling Web3 podcast. We're recording this as of March 2024, so we're in the middle of a bull run. It's absolute cryptomania. Jack is sitting on his desert island, which is kindly blurred out in the background. But yeah, now the ETF approvals have actually all finished, and that kind of little bit of hype has ended to an extent, or actually we're still seeing the ramifications, but the initial hype has ended. Most people, all they're talking about with regards to Bitcoin and the crypto space is the halving. Sounds very imposing, sounds kind of foreshadowing, maybe a bit evil. But today we're going to be doing a little bit of a deep dive into what the Bitcoin halving actually is and what it could mean for the space. So this should be a really interesting one, and hopefully we'll keep it nice and punchy. And as ever, I'm joined by my glorious co-host, Jack Davis, to jump into this topic. Are you excited for this one, mate?
Very excited. You need to find more adjectives for me because you're running out of G's now. But... Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. I think this was the second big event we kind of marked out on our predictions for the year. So as you said, ETFs done, and next on to the halvening, as they say, you know, and we are going through this crazy manic period, March Madness, call it what you want, where we've just seen all-time highs for Bitcoin and a few other the bigger currencies. So everyone's excited about the price at the minute, and the halvening event really that's coming up in, well, when this comes out, it'll be just a few days time. This is the next big milestone on Bitcoin's journey, and we'll go into what it means, but people predict this could have a big impact on the price. I'm not so sure, but we'll get into all that in a bit.
A bit of controversy, and we've only just started. But yeah, let's dive into it. So Bitcoin, obviously, the term that everyone likes to use is this decentralized network. So how in a decentralized network where you have no individual entity actually running the show necessarily, do you get the actual Bitcoins to the masses, to the people? Well, this is one of the interesting things around Bitcoin is actually token issuance, giving the Bitcoins to people in the ecosystem is managed in a decentralized way. And it's actually given to miners in response for managing the network, validating transactions and mining blocks. And when they do this, the network itself actually, or the system itself actually gives them newly minted Bitcoins for their work.
Exactly. So we've described this process before with the mining, and the incentive for the miners is we call it the block reward. And that's comprised of two things, the mining subsidy, which is what the halving relates to, plus your transaction fees for whatever you're paying to use the network. So this is part of the kind of immaculate coinception, let's say, of Bitcoin, and how, you know, people, we talk about the fixed supply of Bitcoin, 21 million Bitcoin split into 100 million satoshis each or something like that. I always forget the number, but essentially you have this 21 million Bitcoin, let's say, and how does that get issued? How do we get to that fixed supply? Well, it's through this block subsidy mechanism, that part of the block reward. So we started out at 50 per block back in the day. Now that's halved three times already, and we're about to approach the fourth time. And the idea of this halving, the reason it's halving over time is so that eventually there will be no new Bitcoin issued. There'll be no kind of fresh Bitcoins being issued every block, and we'll just have the circulating 21 million supply. That's quite a long way off in the future, but that's how we're getting there with these halving events.
Yeah, and it's quite an interesting one. Like, kind of people that aren't in the space, when they ask me about Bitcoin, one of the things they tend to say is, you know, who runs it? Who owns it? Who actually makes the Bitcoins? And I think that's one of the interesting things about this is kind of hard coded into the system, right? That when miners kind of act in this decentralized distributed way for the good of the network by actually mining blocks, they're rewarded automatically by hard code in the system that actually generates these rewards for them. That's how the actual Bitcoins are propagated to the network. But yeah, let's go into this. Like you say, this halving event is really interesting because there's only been a few of them so far, and there's lots of hype and speculation about what they mean. So the very first ever block that was awarded, the rewards in the early days for actually mining a block, you're actually getting 50 Bitcoins in return for mining a block. That seems like an unfathomable amount right now. It's a difficult word to say. And every 4 years, roughly, this halves, right?
Yeah, exactly. So again, when we talk about it being a subsidy, it makes perfect sense that the largest subsidy is earliest on in its history. We talked about Bitcoin's history on the last episode as well. And the fact that it got through those early years, the wilderness years before it was widely adopted, is because there was this relatively large amount of Bitcoins on offer. Now, they didn't have the price it has today, so it was still kind of taking a gamble to be even mining it at that point. But you had the largest, and it, again, because it's all predetermined, because it's all hard-coded in, you know it'll be 50 Bitcoins for the first 4 years, and then 25, and then 12.5 in successive halvings after that. People mining back in 2010 knew that they were getting the largest proportion of the supply that they could per block, right? And it is analogous, I think, to mining precious metals. I think Satoshi talked about it being analogous to mining gold, where you're putting in hard work, hard effort to find these blocks in the same way you would to mine gold or precious metals. And then your reward is this Bitcoins that you get out of that.
Yeah, so the exact quote from Satoshi was, "The steady addition of constant amount of new coins is analogous to gold miners expending resources to add gold to circulation. In our case, it is CPU time and electricity that is expended." Yeah, it's really interesting, this one. I think, like, one of the, you say you're talking about likening this to precious metals, having to put some work in to actually gain some value from that. I think the interesting things right now is we're looking at is, does gold necessarily have a finite amount? Like, how much gold is there in the world? It's difficult to say. And I think one of the beautiful things about Bitcoin is it's predictable. We know exactly how much will be gained year on year. We know exactly when this halving will happen. And we know exactly the amount of maximum supply. So it's far more predictable. And I imagine that makes it a bit more certain for maybe investors and retail adopters, institutional adopters of that because of that.
Yeah, I've seen people joke about gold, but it's true. Maybe it was Elon Musk even that I first saw saying this, but if there was an asteroid made of gold that landed on planet Earth, then all of a sudden your supply of gold has had a massive jump and the price would be significantly affected. Whereas in Bitcoin, it's pretty much guaranteed that it's 21 million Bitcoins. Now, there are other things that could affect that. Maybe we'll discuss that at the end, but let's assume for now nothing changes. The rules of the system basically state that 21 million Bitcoins were issued back in 2009, and they're just slowly being issued individually in these 50 and 25, 12.5, and coming up in a few days' time, it'll just be 3.125 Bitcoins left, right? So that's just being slowly issued out in these dribs and drabs to people. And it's interesting because there's only around 10% of the supply left. I think that's right. And that's quite small in comparison to the amount that's been lost by estimates. I think that that's the rough calculation these days, right?
Yeah, 20% of the total Bitcoin supply has been deemed to be lost in its part. I think some people estimate that's actually in the order of 30 to 35% if you look at the non-confirmed cases as well. And there's a really funny quote on this by Satoshi where he said, "Lost coins only make everyone else's coins worth slightly more. Think of it as a donation to everyone." Like, back in the early days when Bitcoin wasn't worth very much, I imagine that held something. But now it's like people losing hundreds of millions of pounds potentially, and that's like quite devastating.
Yeah. Well, frequent listeners to the podcast will know Alex, a charitable guy, so he's already made his donation to the wider Bitcoin network by losing some of his a few years ago. But yeah, this is all, again, I like to talk of it in terms of this subsidy, because these halving events really focus the mind back onto the evolution of Bitcoin from moving from this very nascent industry, which requires a subsidy to exist, to something which is providing real value, is processing lots of transactions for people, is used for payments or other things. So it's part of this overall transition to a transaction fee based model, because we know for certain at some point, I think it's in the year 2100 or something like that, but, you know, before long, there'll be very few Bitcoins being minted every or issued every new block. So you'll have to be subsisting on the transaction fees, right? And we've seen transaction fees are an issue, but eventually that will be all that the miners get. So it's part of this longer term transitioning to how the reward structure for miners is changing. And that's also, you know, very much by design of Satoshi.
Yeah, I think that's one of the other major points, is this move eventually. Satoshi kind of envisioned this move eventually to miners just being subsidized by the transaction fees, but knowing early on that wasn't possible because there weren't many transaction fees actually going through and they weren't worth that much, right? And I guess one of the primary goals of Bitcoin still is to be able to move money fairly cheaply. And that is not necessarily true right now. And it'd be interesting to see what happens in this kind of future paradigm right now, miners aren't really, I don't know, they're not making that much compared to the actual block reward for mining on the actual transaction fees. I'm not sure what the exact stats are or comparisons between the two, but it doesn't feel, I think it's not that much. It's not that comparable. If the end goal is to be solely benefiting from the transaction fees themselves and nothing to do with the reward that comes from the block, it, surely that means that it's going to be much more expensive to transact on Bitcoin, especially if we're limiting the potential block size of the number of transactions that can actually go through per block.
Yeah, I think I've seen it creeping up over time the last couple of years. The proportion of the total block reward that actually is made up by the fees has been increasing, as you'd expect, as the subsidy decreases. Naturally, that's changing it, but there is more and more of it being allocated to fees anyway. But that is mostly because people are paying very high fees to mine transactions. It's not, as you said, it brings into this whole scalability debate that we discussed on the show last week. You know, how you fill your blocks, well, it depends on the maximum size. So if you have large blocks, then you could fill them with millions of transactions at a low fee. Or if you have the situation you have with Bitcoin currently, you have these very small 1 megabyte blocks where you will have to have high fees to compensate for, you know, if miners want to maintain parity in their revenue, then every time you have this step change in halving the subsidy, then you'd need a corresponding step change increase in the average fee that you're acquiring. Now, there's also an impact on decentralization of the system as well, right? And how sustainable the system is overall, because the less revenue there is in the system, again, this is decreasing the revenue, at least in the short term, then the profitability of mining goes down. Maybe the smaller players have to, you know, exit the game. They can't survive anymore. And then you have fewer and fewer miners. Now, that's not necessarily to say it's against how Bitcoin is meant to work, but it's just a comment on, to lots of people, that's an important feature, is having more miners. And these halving events have the potential, as we've seen in the past, to centralize down to fewer entities.
Okay, got you. Yeah. Right. So let's go to maybe some of the things that have happened in the past, because as we say, like a lot of the crypto space and the crypto narrative is dominated by speculation. You know, number go up, classic. And the reason that I think this is getting so much attention right now is mostly because of the investment piece rather than the actual technology we're talking about. You know, subsidies versus transaction fees and what's going to be, how is the technology going to move forward in the future and how is it going to affect mining right now? But I think most people are kind of interested in this halving because they think it's going to mean more scarcity, more people coming in, and therefore price goes up. So what's happened in the past? So like we said, the first halving was in 2012. This was actually after the days that Satoshi kind of had left the scene. So he could define this economic model. He thought it would work. He talked about it a little bit, but then he actually disappeared before the first halving came into play. So I imagine there was a lot of anticipation about what was going to happen around it. But like I say, it was in 2012. Following, it actually went from Bitcoin was worth around $12 just before the halving. And I think it was a year after, it went up to $1,000. Now, we can't say that they necessarily are directly one-to-one linked. There's a lot of external market factors that are going into this. But, you know, potentially there's some correlation there.
Yeah, and we've seen this pattern play out that normally after the halving, again, we've got three data points to go on, right? It's not many, 2012, and then the following ones in 2016, 2020. Again, we should also mention that spacing, that 4 years apart, is actually not based on time, it's based on number of blocks produced. So it's meant to be every 210,000 blocks. So hopefully we've timed this episode correctly. But if the Bitcoin hash rate soars in the week before, then we'll be late to the party, unfortunately, and then maybe it happens earlier. But as I said, you have the same pattern in 2016. So I think the price was around $650, around that. And then a year to 18 months later, it peaked around 20,000. That was the all-time high in 2017. And then similarly, again, in 2020, when the block reward decreased to 6.25 BTC, then following that, it reached around 60,000. And we're only just hitting those levels again, nearly 4 years later, after a lengthy bear market, let's say.
Yeah. And like I say, we're kind of just comparing two variables right now here. And is that an accurate way of doing it? I don't know. There's some kind of controversy around doing this. Was Bitcoin going to go up regardless of the halving? Hard to say, but it's just interesting. It's just one of the big market factors that people seem to be talking about right now.
What's your take on why these price increases have happened? Because there is a theory that we can go into that some people have come up with, but do you have an opinion on, is this priced in? Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy in many ways? What do you think?
I think I kind of go with the classic supply-demand, right? There's more demand coming in, potentially nothing to do with the halving whatsoever, just more and more people talking about it. And then all of a sudden you create this not artificial reduction in supply, real reduction in supply, but more people kind of speculating and talking about the reduction in supply. And it creates this self-fulfilling hype cycle that people are like, oh my God, there's not much left. If you're going to get in now, like I've seen it play out in the last couple of months, purely with the upcoming halving, people are like, well, if you don't lock in now, you're never going to have a chance to buy Bitcoin. And people definitely play on this narrative. What's your take on it?
Yeah, mine is similar in that I don't think. So there is this argument, and we're going to get into, they call it the stock to flow model. It was made by this guy called Plan B, not the musician, but some kind of crypto analyst. And the stock to flow model basically takes the stock, which is the current supply you have of the system, and the flow. So that's the change in supply you get, right? So that every time you mine a block, that's a small change in supply, and that change is diminishing over time. And it compares what is the current supply, the stock, to the change in supply. And that model has been quite good at tracking, at least, or predicting the price changes broadly for the major halving events we've had. Now, it predicts around $100,000 BTC by April. So we'll know. But by the time this comes out, if we've gained that extra 30K, that'd be interesting if it does happen. But my take on it is not necessarily that there's any fundamental economic reason for this happening. Again, not an economist, but everyone knows the supply change, right? So it's not like a supply shock. It's not like a change that is coming out of nowhere and the economy is reacting to it. It's completely baked in. So my take is that this narrative now exists based on those three data points that the price will go up. Everyone anticipates, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Plus you have, as you said, the fact that the system is just becoming more popular. So the overall demand, regardless of whether this halving system thing was happening at all, is increasing while the supply is just tending towards this fixed limit. So yeah, I don't think there's necessarily anything special in my book about the halving, apart from social media. And most people are telling you to buy Bitcoin right about now. So
it seems like a massive oversimplification, right? To just have two variables effectively defining what the price of something as complex as Bitcoin is going to be. Like, that doesn't take into account what's going on social media, what's going on institutionally, what's going around globally, war, all these things. I think anyone who thinks that they can, you know, work at anything economically or related to the economy tends to be wrong. They're right for a certain amount of time, then eventually they're wrong, and there's an exception that breaks the rule typically. But yeah, what we're seeing is Bitcoin's always gone up for kind of, this is probably the best time to be in Bitcoin right now. Not financial advice. And what is it? History is not a prediction of the future. But yeah, it doesn't always go up in the way you intend to. It's certainly not been linear for anyone who's been in the space for more than the last 3 months.
Yeah, and that's why I mentioned the lag. It is important to note that the effects of this might, based on history, might not be felt for another year to 18 months. So it'd be interesting to look back on this in a year's time and see how right or wrong we were. But it's
gives us time to get away, Jack. You're like, anything we say in here, we've got 12 to 18 months to get away, basically, and move to the Cayman Isles.
Pretty much. We won't be held accountable by our subscribers until then, which is nice.
So less about the speculation. Let's talk about the miners, because they're the people that lose out in all of this. Like, just at a high level initially, it's mind blowing to think you have this business model, say you're somewhat profitable, you get in, what is it, say 6.25 Bitcoins right now? 6.25 yeah. Bitcoins right now for every time you mine a block. And mining's kind of irregular, but I imagine you can predict it roughly over the course of years, how much you're going to mine. And then all of a sudden, overnight, the amount of Bitcoins you receive per block mined halves. It doesn't matter if you can predict that or not and look into the future and know exactly when that's going to happen. At the end of the day, your revenue potentially overnight halves. That's not including the blockchain transaction fees. That's mind-boggling. Like, it must be an absolute, I don't know, nightmare for those kind of companies.
Yeah, and again, at least they've had forewarning that this will happen, but it doesn't change the impact when it does arrive. And the fact that they will overnight have to try and compensate this halving in the block subsidy that they'd otherwise be getting. That's 3 Bitcoins. That's worth, what, over 200 grand at the minute, $200,000. So that's not insignificant per block. So if you're a big miner and you're mining, you know, 20, 30 blocks a day, that's a big dent in your bottom line. And as one of the effects of this is that you will see potentially a reduction in hash rate for Bitcoin, because either the bigger miners will deploy a little bit less and they might have to scale down operations in the short term, especially if they're waiting for Bitcoin price to increase. If that's a 12-month lag, they're not getting it replaced straight away. So they might have to pare down. And the smaller operations, we have seen in the past that they've closed down following halving. So I saw there was a report by Galaxy Digital that they estimate roughly 20% reduction may happen as a result of this halving in the BTC hash rate immediately following this, right? Which would be pretty significant.
Wow, that is fascinating. I didn't imagine that would happen. Like, I understood that the number of miners that could actually compete in this space would lessen, but I didn't think there'd be, for some reason, obviously that does correspond to a reduction in hash rate overall if there's less competitors. But like you said earlier, this is potentially a big issue for a network that kind of, in its way, highlights itself as this decentralized network with, you know, it's resistant to single points of failure and all this kind of stuff. The idea of less and less miners being able to compete in this space, potentially leading to centralization, potentially then being more susceptible to control by a few large entities, is, I imagine, quite worrying in the space. And like you say, like, another impact of this is because all of a sudden the revenue goes potentially significantly down, they have to become more efficient and they have to look at better ways to manage energy costs, maybe more advanced hardware. One thing I saw is that you actually get a lot of miners as a result of halvings, changing geographical location, moving to areas that are maybe much cheaper, using renewable energy sources, which is definitely a boon, moving to places where there's excess power available and turning, you know, regions that aren't necessarily just set up for it, like the Western world, maybe less economically developed countries, and actually using them for their, you know, cheaper energy supply.
Yeah, if I had to make one prediction about the impact of this halving, it would probably be on the energy distribution, how much of it is from renewables, because renewable energy, there's a big upfront cost to having it, but once you've got it, it's kind of free, in a sense, to simplify, but you get this free renewable source of energy. So it makes so much sense for Bitcoin miners to go renewable, and we've seen more and more of the Bitcoin hash rate being replaced by renewable sources, but that has been partly mandated by a lot of the regulatory leanings and kind of murmurings from many different countries on how Bitcoin should be sourcing its energy. Now that impetus is going to be provided by the market, by Bitcoin itself, saying your margins are getting thinner. You can't afford to keep producing energy. You can't afford to keep hashing based on the same old model. And partly not just the energy costs as well, but the hardware, because these ASICs, they go through them so quickly. That on top of everything is a humongous cost that they have to replace the mining hardware. So I've actually seen lots of really interesting projects around using renewable energy to cool the mining rigs as well, right? This is something, I mean, I actually went and saw one of these back in Cardiff. Someone's got a mining rig and it's immersed in this coolant fluid, but the fluid itself isn't conductive. So you can have these ASICs, and the ASICs are just the machines that you're mining from, right? These dumb computers that are computing hashes over and over again. And it's really bizarre to see them because they're submerged in this clear liquid. You think, why isn't this blowing up? This should be working, but it's cooling them down. And because it's immersed, it's much more efficient at doing that. And you can use renewable energy to do that. So I think there's so much innovation actually going on right now. You've seen the Sustainable Bitcoin Protocol. They're doing lots of work on reducing the reliance on fossil fuels of Bitcoin mining. So I just think that is going to be a huge impact now that those margins are squeezed even more.
That's a little bit of insight into what you're doing on your weekends. Yeah, so I think one of the next big things that we touched on already, which is, you know, absolutely fascinating, is about network security, like the miners. Right now, they're receiving these, you know, well, it's quite big subsidies, right, of Bitcoin to actually mine blocks. What's going to happen when all of that runs out, if the transaction fees, the per transaction they're actually going through, aren't equivalent to what they're getting right now for the rewards for mining blocks? Could this lead to a security problem? Could we have, like you said, already you're saying their estimates that the hash power of Bitcoin will potentially reduce by 20% as a result of this halving. Are there going to be any long-term consequences of this? I mean, one of the quotes by Satoshi about this is, in a few decades, when the reward gets too small, the transaction fee will become the main compensation for nodes. So he foresaw this, he knew this was going to happen, and he had this idea of a transition of the economic model from block rewards to transaction fees. But right now, is there enough transactions actually going on to, say, Bitcoin to potentially use this and make this sustainable in the future?
Yeah, I think my guess would be yes. It's for at least the next halving cycle, the next 4 years, it can be sustainable for the miners because there is enough demand to pay significant, huge fees, exorbitant fees to use the network. Is it sustainable for the end users? I think potentially not, right? Because every time this happens, you are pricing out more and more end users from actually accessing the chain. And that doesn't just affect people who want to use L1 day to day, as we said in the layer 2 episode, you have things like Lightning Network built on top of it, but you don't always stay in the layer 2. You want to open and close channels to settle your bar tab every so often. So it's going to impact even those people who are using layer 2, especially, you know, we've got El Salvador now completely using layer 2 in the Lightning Network. It's going to impact them as well, because now the cost of settling those transactions is going to be that much higher in the future. So is it sustainable for users? I think potentially not.
And what I've seen is, we talked about it in a lot of detail in the history of Bitcoin episode, about the idea of scalability, the idea of block sizes, basically the number of transactions that a miner can process per given block. And right now that is fixed, that is limited. And rather than the potentially the actual transaction fees going up to make up for this, to sustain miners in the future when the block subsidy goes down, the block reward goes down, could they increase the number of transactions that goes through and make sure that the actual transaction fee goes down? And this is something that I've actually seen people starting to have a discussion about this again, is do we need to increase the number of transactions to make sure that we can compete and can keep the transaction fees down to actually get the transaction throughput into the network to keep it healthy and sustainable?
Yeah, you're right. I think the halvings always tend to be a reason to restoke the fire of the scalability debate. Do we go small blocks or do we go big blocks and change how the fees are paid, basically, and who pays for the fees? So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we see that as an effect if there are more. I've seen talks already in splintering in the BTC community about that. So yeah, it's interesting. And this kind of brings us on to the whole idea of Bitcoin as an economic system, right? Because it's this nice blend of cryptography, network science, and also economics. And it's probably one of the more interesting things. So many people, especially in the institutional space, are even more and more starting to treat Bitcoin as digital gold, right? So not necessarily cash, but some hard asset, people call it, that is not so subject to inflation. So people are starting to see it on their balance sheets now. You see MicroStrategy buying even more Bitcoin. Big companies, even with the ETFs, are starting to appreciate the idea of Bitcoin as an asset. But it's playing into this wider digital gold narrative, right?
And honestly, I think that the narrative of digital gold, we both said in a way, is problematic if you think of Bitcoin as its original intended, you know, peer-to-peer cash system. But it definitely helps with the sales pitch. Like when you're talking to these big financial institutes, these people who are kind of experts in economics but have no idea about cryptography, have no idea about Bitcoin and the technology behind it, and you try and talk about this decentralized network of people getting rewards from this hard-coded blah blah blah, I imagine they just glaze over instantly. But as soon as you make the comparison and the story of digital gold, you know, people are mining gold from who knows where, and then you accrue more, but there is a limited supply at the end of the day, I imagine it just makes those conversations so much easier. And what I've seen online from like BlackRock CEO Larry Fink, he was completely against Bitcoin in the early days. Like his whole agenda has changed completely. He's done a full U-turn the last, you know, 4 years, 3 years even. And now he's saying things along the lines of, you know, as governments are navigating these mounting debt burdens and there's inflation left, right, and center, we can't trust people to make the right decisions and central banks to make the right decisions about issuance. He says he's starting to promote Bitcoin scarcity and this decentralized offering as a real value proposition, as a real alternative to our current solutions for finance. And it kind of blows my mind a little bit, because he was saying the complete opposite 5 years ago. And maybe it's just because they've got an investment and a stake in Bitcoin now. But it is really interesting to see the big institutes and traditional kind of economic institutes really jumping into this.
Yeah. And I think it's good to talk about this scarcity idea, because for lots of people now, that's where they believe. And again, all of this is belief, really. It's depending on who you ask. Who can define what value is? But for a lot of people, Bitcoin's value is derived from its scarcity. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but it goes back to this point of Bitcoin is fundamentally an economic experiment, right? It's experimental in nature. So this idea of the issuance of a fixed supply and in kind of these increments over time that exponentially decrease, no one's ever done this before. People have done it since in droves, but no one's ever done it in the same way and to the same scale in terms of use and notoriety that Bitcoin has. And this is all an experiment. And the scarcity piece, people talk about Bitcoin being deflationary, right? And I think of that as deflationary with respect to a traditional fiat currency like a US dollar, so that its value shouldn't decrease over time because you don't have printing. You don't have additional printing of Bitcoin now. Okay, at the minute, this is why I get to have a bit of a bugbear here. You are printing Bitcoin every block, mm-hmm. But the difference being this is within the wider framework of the fixed supply. So beyond that fixed supply, you can't have it printed. And the market knows these parameters of the system. It knows how many there will be. It knows the issuance rate. Whereas in your traditional currency, you can print stupid amounts of money. I saw some ridiculous fact the other day. I don't remember the exact percentage, but some humongous chunk of the US dollar has been printed in the last year. I think like over 50%, I think it was, which is mind-boggling to me as a fact.
Well, I just saw the debt increases in the US by $1 trillion every 40 days. And I can see that, you know, a lot of the kind of the Bitcoin maxis are using this in the Twitter sphere to say, well, why the hell would you buy into this? I think one of the comparisons is that people think the amount of money they have is going up every year if you invest in the S&P and all these kind of traditional stocks and funds. But if you look at your purchasing power related to that bigger number, it actually doesn't go up that much. And this is a real reason. I saw the Coinbase kind of one of the first ads that Coinbase did. And it was all about this problem with investment. You work your whole life and you put money into the system and you can't buy the house that could be bought 50 years ago. You can't buy the car that could be bought 20 years ago. And I don't know how much I agree with it. This is not financial advice, as we always say. But their angle was you invest in crypto assets because actually a lot of them do enable you to live that life that you were told you could live if you kind of performed in the, you know, the prescribed way from the government. And yeah, it's a really interesting one. I think another really interesting point is we talk about Bitcoin is hard-coded and everything, all this scarcity, this limited supply, this fixed supply is hard-coded. But as we've talked about in the past, you know, the miners are actually running the hard code. They're running Bitcoin itself. So is this 21 million actually fixed? Question.
Yeah, we're getting controversial now. I'm glad you bring it up because... yeah, this is a genuine question, and it's one that's been posed before. Again, it was talked relatively seriously by some of the Bitcoin developers a number of years ago, and I've seen it cropping up again, is the idea of expanding the supply because of the reducing issuance of new Bitcoins over time. And to say, how is this economically stable? Well, we're going to have to print more. And if you look at something like Ethereum, they don't have a fixed supply, right? They've kind of abandoned this notion. I'm not entirely sure if they ever did have it, to be honest. But they have a supply that's totally in flux now. You have new Ether minted all the time, and you have it burned by transaction fees. You don't have that in Bitcoin. You do supposedly have this hard-coded limit. But what if the developers of the software decide to suddenly change it one day? What if they convince the miners? There is precedent for, as we saw in last week's episode, there is precedent for the developers in Bitcoin kind of forcing changes upon miners. Now, we're in a very different situation to where we were years ago with lots of those changes, things like SegWit. But there is a valid question there, I think. And you have to permit some trust that 21 million limit will always be the limit and it won't be increased.
My prediction is if that ever happens, if there is a serious discussion around increasing the limited supply, I really do think Bitcoin would potentially like cripple overnight. I think the price would just completely plummet, but not financial advice. And I don't think they would do that because like they're making their entire money off the value of Bitcoin and they know the effects. When everyone's talking about scarcity, limited supply, that is probably one of the defining features right now of Bitcoin. It's the one that most of the institutions are talking about anyway. If they start to have a serious conversation about this, they know that it would screw up their entire business. I can't imagine miners buying into that now. Maybe in the early days when we were talking about, like I say, the cash system, but now it's this digital gold scarcity is king at the end of the day, I think. Yeah. And one thing that I would want to bring up on this as well, because this came up in a conversation with my mom the other day, because she was like, oh, I'm hearing about crypto and I'm listening to the podcast, and she's like, well, how many Bitcoins do you have? You talk about it all the time. And I'm like, well, I have a third of a Bitcoin or something like that. And she's like, you have a third of a Bitcoin? Like, what the hell is a third of a Bitcoin? Like, how does this, if I had a third of a pound, I wouldn't be talking about it on a podcast. And I was like, well, actually, you know, Bitcoin is divisible. We need to, I don't think we actually said this before, but it is divisible into smaller denominations of 100 million. It's 100 million satoshis per Bitcoin.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and we should just emphasize that point that there aren't just 21 million Bitcoins. There's 21 million times 100 million satoshi. So there is enough divisibility to actually exchange it round.
Yeah, I'm glad you reminded me of the actual number because I was fishing around for it earlier. But so the base unit in the system is the satoshi, and there are 2.1 times 10 to the 15 of those. Okay, that's a big number, but there is a price at which, you know, that satoshi amount could become quote unquote, too high for practical use. You can't divide it into smaller things anymore. And that's one of the other reasons I've seen people mentioning about increasing the supply. Well, if it ever got so big and so valuable, then you would want more kind of smaller denominations to use it. And that would effectively inflate the supply. Now, yeah, I agree with you. I don't necessarily think we'll ever get to increasing the supply for the reasons you stated. I think we've hit that level of institutional awareness and adoption, and the narrative kind of, people have taken up this narrative around the digital gold angle and where the values come from. That would be anathema to everyone. I just think it wouldn't get through. And if Bitcoin ever got so big and so valuable that we needed more units of it, I think people are probably going to be pretty happy anyway. So it's probably, if it did happen, it would probably be for reasons that nobody really cares about. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It's an interesting point.
Yeah, and I think like we're coming to the end of the show now. And in my mind, the kind of the main points to take away from this is Bitcoin's an experiment in a way. It's like when we think about the digital space and digital kind of interaction, I personally never really think of it as being finite. We've talked about the metaverse previously and how it kind of opens up this potentially infinite space for us to operate in, for us to transact in, to commit commerce in. And that is quite exciting for a lot of reasons. But Bitcoin is not that, and it is digital scarcity in a way. It's like the kind of the digital gold scarcity. And it's really interesting to see how we're nowhere near it. Like you said, the kind of the final time that miners will receive rewards from the network for actually mining blocks is something like, I don't know, it's 2150. So it's like in 100 years or something like that. So we are far away from it, but it'd be really interesting to see how it plays out until then, because this is a complete experiment. And it's interesting to see that Satoshi back in 2008, pre-2008, imagined this without really having the ability to micro-tune as it was going along and kind of set this plan out. And now we're seeing how everything plays out.
Yeah, I think it kind of reminds me of why I fell in love with Bitcoin a little bit, right? Because it is this kind of big, living, breathing experiment. At the end of the day, it's got its own characteristics, its own personality. It has this halving cycle. It had to grow up, right? It has to grow up even further from this subsidized kind of infancy to it being a fully fledged adult of the monetary world. And I think it's the most interesting economic experiment there's ever been. And we're lucky enough to be living to see it play out. And every 4 years, these halving events are just some of the way markers. I like using them as a yardstick to see how well has Bitcoin done over the last halving cycle, not just in terms of price, but in terms of adoption, technical changes, how it's being used, what it's being used for. So I just think it's a very interesting time to take stock on the wider role of Bitcoin in general. And it does highlight this tension between, as we've said, between the use of Bitcoin as the digital gold asset, as an asset and as a speculative vehicle, versus it being used as a currency for payments and how its initial use was. So yeah, it's an interesting time to take stock of, is Bitcoin now giving up on that value proposition? Because the more halvings we have, the more it kind of goes down the digital gold route. But yeah, it's just, for me, it's just a piece of interesting kind of history that we'll probably be writing about one day and say we were there.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think it would be really, really on the utility versus speculation point that you just made. As you say, they're going for this digital gold narrative. And eventually, we're saying right now, unless things change drastically, they're going to have to move to a purely transaction fee model. And as soon as you go down that route, and as soon as miners have to make up, you know, a lot more money from a lot fewer transactions, potentially limited transactions at least, the utility angle all of a sudden becomes much more expensive and therefore difficult to do. So I think it is leading them down that route. I think that is, unfortunately, to the detriment of Bitcoin, but there'll be other people that will capitalize on that. There'll be other blockchains, potentially. Ethereum is really targeting towards the utility angle, but there'll also be layer twos that build on that. And if we're limited in the number of transactions we can put in a block, then, and they cost a lot of money, then all of a sudden you have layer two roll-up side chains that can fit more transactions on top of that single transaction, divide the price between them all. So it's not the end of utility potentially, it's just maybe foreshadowing that.
A very poignant place to end, Alex. So yeah, I think hopefully that has given everyone a good overview of what's actually happening in the next couple of days with the halving event. It's also worth reminding ourselves that it's occurring across multiple blockchains, not exactly the same time. So we've referring to the BTC halving, but there's a similar one for all the kind of chains coming off that. So Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV as well. So they will play out at various different times. But yeah, that kind of sums up what it is and the impact of it. And I think, yeah, we should check back in a year to see if our predictions were right or if they were way off the mark. So I think that's a good place to end this one. So yeah, we'll sign off there, and thanks at home for listening, wherever you may be, and join us next time to untangle a little more of Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3, produced by Emma Camilleri.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.